Do you see a comparison between the assassination of John Kennedy and the attacks on 9/11?
Yes, because well, I mean, personally, what I think that was the same template. Now, of course, you know, my position is that the Mossad was the prime conspirator behind the Kennedy assassination, just as it was on 9/11.
A warm welcome to listeners all around the world on the World Wide Web. You're listening to Signs of the Times.
If you were alive in 1963, you'll no doubt remember where you were when you heard the news that John F. Kennedy had been shot. The same way that you'll never forget where you were when you heard that an airliner, and then two, had crashed into the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. It was as if the bottom had fallen out of your world. There was a feeling of hope in the United States during the Kennedy years. The war in Vietnam had yet to capture the headlines and set the young generation against their parents. The civil rights movement was growing in strength. As Bob Dylan put it, the times, they were a-changing. On November 22, 1963, that hope for change was crushed under a dark cloud of brain and bone that showered off the president's head. In the aftermath, the Warren Commission produced a report that was an obvious cover-up. And although the majority of Americans suspected it was a cover-up, nothing was done. It was the first nail in the coffin that was to be firmly shut 38 years later. It's obvious to anyone who studies the documentary evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald was not the killer of Kennedy. It's obvious to anyone who studies the evidence that the single bullet could not have performed the magic tricks ascribed to it before it fell out of John Connolly's thigh and landed on the stretcher. It's obvious to anyone who studies the evidence that the elimination of Kennedy was not the work of a lone gunman, a solitary individual with a mental problem and an axe to grind. It was the work of a group. The assassination of JFK and the attacks of 9/11 are the two greatest crimes ever committed against the American people, the two bookends of a seizure of power by the most reactionary forces in the country. We should not be surprised that the same forces were responsible for both. And it's the same force that then pushed for war in the Middle East, condemned Saddam Hussein for having weapons of mass destruction sold to him by those who would later put him on trial, and who rained bombs down upon the Palestinian people. There's been much obfuscation around Kennedy's death, with theories on who was responsible, ranging from the mob to anti-Castro Cubans to the CIA to Lyndon Johnson and the oil magnates. As Laura has shown in her recent series of articles on JFK, many, many different groups hated him, felt threatened by the changes he was attempting to bring to the U.S. political system, and they each had the motive. Michael Collins Piper, in his book on the Kennedy assassination, Final Judgment, shows that, in a certain sense, all of the various explanations are correct. Each of the aforementioned groups had a hand in the assassination. What Piper demonstrates, however, is that there was another hand at play, the puppeteer who had the power to place the different groups on Dealey Plaza on that day. Michael Collins Piper is our guest on today's Signs of the Times podcast. He talked with Laura Knight Yadchik earlier this week.
What I've been doing is, and it's just like kind of a personal thing for me, is I've been doing like this little commemorative thing about John Kennedy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the reason is, I mean, this is the 43rd anniversary, and that seems to be like an odd number. You know, mostly people do commemorations on even-numbered anniversaries, you know, like 40th or 50th or 30th or whatever. 43 does seem to be an odd number, but quite a number of years ago I had a dream. And it was kind of an interesting dream because a voice said to me in the dream that the secret is in locker 43.
Really?
Yeah. So for me, the number 43 became kind of significant. I don't know what it means or if it means anything in particular. Could have just been a glitchy dream. But anyway,
he was also 43 years old, I believe, when he died, wasn't he?
I don't remember. I don't know.
He was born in 1917.
1917.
I guess that would make him 46 then.
Yeah, but yeah, then that would mean he was 43 when he was elected, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Let's see, 1917. 1963 minus 1917 equals, yeah, 46 when he died, so that would mean he was 43 when he was elected, eh?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so there's the 43. And, but anyway, it's kind of like a personal thing for me to do it. And especially since I'm looking at the world we're living in today and comparing it to the world we would have lived in had he not been assassinated.
You know, I will tell you, I've only told a few people this, and when I say a few, I mean probably less than 20 people, maybe 25 people. I've increasingly told expanding numbers of it, but about a month before I actually started writing Final Judgment, I had a dream in which I was in the air over Dealey Plaza, and I was watching the Kennedy motorcade, and then all of a sudden, I was like moving down right onto the scene and watching the whole assassination take place, seeing from a vantage point, although I don't remember any of the specific details, but I was seeing not only where the gunmen were, where the bullets were striking, but I was seeing in little graphics, in little blocks, like I was looking at a big collage. But I remember as very distinct blocks, I was seeing, like, who the real conspirators were.
Mm-hmm.
At the bigger picture, and then it pulled right down into it as though I was almost in the car with Kennedy, that close, you know, watching it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like I was watching the Zapruder film. It was like it was right down, like if I would be on the floor almost between Kennedy and Governor Connolly.
Mm-hmm.
And then I woke up from that dream with the feeling that I had seen everything that had happened, but I couldn't remember the specifics. And it was about a month after that things started to fall into place for me as far as writing Final Judgment was concerned. And I really believe that was a combination of my years of, I don't even want to call it research, a culmination of years of having read so much about the assassination.
Mm-hmm.
And been exposed to various people in some ways. Like, I used to work for John Connolly for a couple months, you know, when he ran for president, and I knew Mark Lane very, very well, and Fletcher Prouty, and just other people who've been connected in different ways, you know, in various aspects, two or three degrees apart from the conspiracy, or even people who've been implicated in the conspiracy. I've known some of these people. And it was like everything was just being put together for me.
Do you see a comparison between the assassination of John Kennedy and the attacks on 9/11?
Yes. Because well, I mean, personally, what I think that was the same template. Now, of course, you know, my position is that the Mossad was the prime conspirator behind the Kennedy assassination, just as it was on 9/11. And in 9/11, what we had were these phony war games that were being conducted. These, you know, they had these war games being conducted, and you know, people didn't know whether it was a real terrorist attack, whether it was a real hijackings of planes, or whether they were just part of the war games. Well, this is essentially what I believe is the template used in the Kennedy assassination, that there were people in the presidential security, people in the CIA perhaps, or, well, definitively in the CIA. They were staging they thought there was going to be a phony assassination attempt on the president, one that would be presented to the public as a very real thing and used as a pretext to either force Kennedy to invade Cuba. So while one of these phony operations was being conducted, real assassins were moved into place.
Mm-hmm.
So while there might have been somebody firing a blank shot from somewhere in Dealey Plaza, somebody else in Dealey Plaza is firing a shot. But on a bigger picture, there's another aspect of it, too, and that is that I've heard it suggested that the Warren Commission cover-up was designed to fall apart, just as people have suggested that the whole 911 cover-up was so obviously a cover-up in the first place, that it's kind of a signal to the population at large that, hey, we can kill your president and get away with it and tell you absolute lies about it as an official government document, but you can't question us because we'll call you a nut or a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
The same thing with 911. There's so many of these little holes in the official story, some of which, you know, are so obviously holes in the official story, and yet the media, along with the government and whoever else is playing a part in it, the actual mechanics who carried out the crime, they're all sitting back laughing and saying, hey, we got away with this. This is what we can do to you, and just imagine what else we can do to you. We can kill your president, or we can knock down your World Trade Center. We can attack your Pentagon, and you can't stop us.
Yeah, I came to a similar conclusion myself because one thing I noticed as I was going through all the material was that, you know, for example, one person will say the mob did it, the mafia, and another person will say, oh, it was the anti-Castro Cubans who did it, and then another person will say, no, it was the CIA who did it, and so on and so forth. And yet what you see is a conjunction of all of these elements, and yet in each of these elements you find that, you know, some of them get killed, get bumped off, so that they can't testify.
Exactly.
And so that tells you that it can't be a mob element that's in control of it, because they wouldn't bump off their own people. It can't be CIA. They wouldn't knock off their people. It can't be military. They wouldn't be knocking off their people. There's something else at the apex.
There's another thread, you see, and like I say, you know, and it's kind of funny because, you know, a lot of people, when they first heard about my book, they say, oh, here's another theory. Well, it's, you know, there's some people, you know, say, oh, the KKK did it. Some people say right-wing extremists did it. Some people say the Texas oil men, you know, and they set off these different categories. You know, but in fact, at least in terms of the approach that I took, you can draw a definitive, not, you know, some people then say, oh, well, he says the Jews did it. That isn't what the book says.
Mm-mm.
The book says that you can define, there's a definitive, not just Israeli lobby connection, but a definitive Mossad connection.
Mm-hmm.
That people either directly in association with the Mossad, or people one step away from the Mossad through very definitive contacts at one point or another, were immersed or enmeshed in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And see, that's why it's not like it's... And then there's other critics of the book have come forth and said, oh, well, now he throws the Mossad into the mix, and how could all these people be interacting at one time? Well, it's actually, as I've defined it, it's actually a very, very small, tightly knit group of people with the ability to manipulate considerably larger numbers of people.
Exactly.
Who may not even know for what purposes they're working.
Yeah.
And that's like, I think, what happened with Clay Shaw in New Orleans. Because of that movie JFK, he's taken on the image of being one of the big conspirators.
Mm-hmm.
Far from it.
Mm-hmm.
Far from it. He was involved in kind of like one little corner manipulating Lee Harvey Oswald in a couple small operations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure Clay Shaw had no idea that John F. Kennedy was going to be killed. You know, and since
yeah.
that time, you know, Joan Mellon has written this book in defense of Jim Garrison.
Mm-hmm.
And she asserts in her book, and we just have to take her word on it, that on his deathbed, Clay Shaw essentially admitted that Jim Garrison was right, but what he said was essentially what he said, and this is a terrible misquote or it's far from direct. He said something along the lines of, you know, when you get involved in things and you don't know exactly what's going on, you might do things and you don't know what the end result will be. Jim Garrison, he was on the right track, something along those lines. You know, in other words, he was saying, well, yeah, I was involved in some things that were connected to the Kennedy assassination, but I didn't know they were going to kill John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
Yeah, or after the fact, he discovered that he had been in contact with Lee Harvey Oswald doing things, you know, at the request of others. So,
right.
So many, that's been one of the things that has happened over the years, that so many people were brought into the Kennedy assassination conspiracy unwittingly. They may have delivered a bag of cash from one place to another, and it turns out they were paying off one of the assassins but didn't know it, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody had something to hide.
Well, that's that takes me to another aspect of that. For example, there is this this film that I just recently watched, put out by Wim Dankbar.
Yes, I haven't seen it, but I'm familiar with some of the things he's written about. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm watching this, and basically, I get the idea that it's probably true that this guy did fire the headshot that killed Kennedy, you know, or one of them.
James Files, yeah.
But the entire film gives the impression that there were, you know, two or three mob hitmen in Dealey Plaza on that day, and that was the whole show. And somehow I get the impression that that wasn't the whole show, that there was possibly a mob hit team, and there could have possibly been a Mossad hit team, there could have been a CIA hit team, all these different hit teams that were there and didn't know about each other.
Hey, well, see, that's another aspect of it, exactly. That different, yeah, the one group, you know, but say, just look at it this way. Say it can literally be compartmentalized as one is a mob hit team, one is a CIA hit team, one is a Mossad hit team, when, of course, the three of them are all intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
But just look at it from that perspective. Okay. Each of those teams could be told, okay, you're going to be here. One of you is, you know, and they're all operating independently, but each of them are told, when you hear the first shot come out of the Texas School Book Depository, you take aim and fire.
Right.
And then you hear, there's that one little shot comes out of the Texas School Book Depository, and then there's a team on the grassy knoll, a team in the Dow Tech building, and a team in the sewer.
Right.
All those shots are fired at one time. Somebody's, unless they're really bad, somebody's going to hit the target.
Right.
And then there's going to be a backup. One of them, they're going to be told, if it looks as though we need a backup, you know, or maybe one is told to only fire if it looks as though, you know, I mean, I don't need to go into details. I mean, we could spin on that forever.
Mm-hmm.
But what I tend to think in general is that was the basic model, that what was used was that there was actually, and Bobby Kennedy, it's quite possible from what I've seen in some new material, Bobby Kennedy himself may have been running the phony assassination attempt. Because, you know, the Kennedys were playing a couple tracks with Castro, you know, and they may have been, one of their backup ideas was to, at least Bobby Kennedy may have set this thing up to have a phony assassination attempt on Kennedy, his brother, that would be traced back to, you know, a pro-Castro agitator who escaped to Cuba. And then, of course, because, of course, it wasn't officially going to be traced back to Oswald. It was going to be traced back to Alec Heidel, you know, phony identity, you know, the whole deal. But in any case, then, of course, the real assassins stepped into place and fired real shots. And, of course, even Frank Sturgis, for example, now there's a good example. He is often cast in the role of kind of like a CIA coordinator for anti-Castro Cubans. That's the general perception of him. But, you know, it's very interesting. You actually look at a lot of the material very closely, look at a lot of the material surrounding Frank Sturgis, and it's not really clear that he was answering directly to the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
He was moving in CIA circles.
Right.
But he was also, this is the thing about it, he was also moving in Mossad circles.
Oh, boy.
At the same time. So even, and it, his source of funding was always very, very unclear, but all the indications are that it was Jewish organized crime money with Lansky and Mossad connections.
Right.
So even there, it's kind of like just a little bit out of the realm that most people understand, because that whole aspect of the Mossad and Kennedy's fight with Israel over nuclear weapons, that was buried for so long that no one ever had any reason to look in that direction. You know, I mean, so even if people did catch on to Frank Sturgis's Mossad connections, they would say, well, that doesn't mean anything because, you know, Kennedy was a good friend of Israel, blah, blah, blah. Well, which was not the case at all. So, you know, it's like all these little areas, you know, now you have you have the fifth or the most recent edition,
right,
of Final Judgment. You see those different charts I've laid together there.
Mm-hmm.
It's about as close as I've been able to try to conceptualize it. You know, and that's in that one chart I have in the book, right? It's a box. There's all sorts of boxes interconnected with lines. There's that one area that you always see talked about, but those Israeli connections are always just not discussed.
Yeah.
It's not even a matter of suppressing them. It's just a matter of just not talking about them. You know,
right.
And of course, in some ways, that's very, very comfortable. You know, it's in the comfort zone, you know, and I understand that, but for a lot of people. But, you know, and they always say to me, a lot of people say, well, you have an axe to grind because you've been a critic of Israel for years. And I say, well, yes, that's true. But on the other hand, it's probably only someone with my axe to grind, someone who has read the literature, who is familiar with the subject matter, who bothers to look into these areas like JFK's war with Israel over nuclear weapons, and also someone who's identified with the issue and doesn't have to give up their career by daring to talk about it.
Yeah.
Because I've already got the target on me. You know, I don't have anything to lose, but I mean, there's a lot of people who've been writing about the JFK assassination for years and who've been invited to come on television talk shows. The minute they said Mossad, that would be the end of the gravy train for them.
Well, for me, it was a little bit different because I didn't start out with any idea of any Israeli involvement in anything. It was examining the evidence that made it so clear that I couldn't deny it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's I even say this in Final Judgment. I say that, years ago, my mother had said to me, she said, why don't you write a book on the Kennedy assassination? And I said, well, there's no, because she'd read most of the books that I had read just because they were around our house, you know. And I said, well, I just don't see any reason to write the book because I think pretty much it's all, you know, said and done. At that point, I was inclined to think it was a CIA faction hooked up with the Cubans, you know, and then it went no further than that. You know, and I was like, so why write anything more about it? You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, and you know, it's funny. It's funny. In one of the editions of Final Judgment, I only mentioned it in passing, but in the photo section. But Richard Perle himself, the Prince of Darkness,
yes,
played a part in instigating the phony story that E. Howard Hunt was E. Howard Hunt may have been in Dealey Plaza, but he wasn't one of the tramps. You know, he looks an awful lot like the tramp. But even Mark Lane doesn't believe Hunt was in, and a lot of people misunderstand that about Mark Lane's book, Plausible Denial. They think that Mark contends that Hunt was actually in Dallas on the day of the assassination. Not at all. But Mark trapped hunt into basically hunt had things to cover up.
Yeah.
And as a consequence of, you know, he told different stories to different people before he got his final story settled as to where he was and what he was doing and whether or not he'd been in Dallas at all. So he couldn't get those stories straight. And then when Mark got him on the stand and tore him to pieces, it was such that you couldn't believe anything Hunt said.
Yeah.
Hunt was involved in some way, but probably not planning to kill Kennedy. He was probably one of the guys who was coordinating this dummy assassination attempt.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it got turned into the real thing.
Okay, but hold on. Yeah. Let's take 1 minute break here. Getting back to this subject of Mossad, and you know, there's in the Bay of Pigs and so forth. In this, have you read Farewell America?
Yes. Very interesting book. The origins of it are
interesting.
Murky and interesting, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, there was, as I was reading this, and I've been putting huge excerpts of it up on my blog and in my articles on the web, and a reader sent me in, as a result of reading these articles, sent me a link to a speech that John Kennedy made on, I think it was April 27th of 1961. So the title of the speech was The President and the Press, and it was delivered to the American Newspaper Publishers Association at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York.
Yes.
And it was 10 days after the Bay of Pigs fiasco.
Yes, that's an interesting, I've seen that. Somebody just sent it to me again recently.
Mm-hmm. Right, where he says in there, "For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, in infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned. No rumor is printed. No secret is revealed. It conducts the Cold War, in short, with a wartime discipline no democracy would ever hope to wish to match." And when I read that, I realized that what happened between the time John Kennedy authorized the Bay of Pigs invasion at, 1:30 in the afternoon, and then he rescinded that order at something like, 9:30 at night?
Is that what the time frame was, that whole, yeah?
Something like that, yeah. That he must have learned something. And he was, in fact, declaring war on this, what did he call it, a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy. So John Kennedy was a conspiracy theorist.
Well, you know, that's the funny thing about that speech by Kennedy, that couldn't, were that delivered by any person today, any sitting politician today, they would be pulled off the stage with your old classic hook, you know?
Right.
They would say, uh-oh, this person has gone off the deep end. We've got a real problem here. Such a thing, no politician today would ever dare say that publicly. It's amazing, you know. But I'll tell you what is really interesting about that speech is that although it was recorded, they filmed that speech. You got to think back in the context of 1963 versus 2006.
43 years ago.
Well, 43 years precisely. Yeah, you know, back in those days, that speech was probably never printed anywhere except maybe in some official roster of the president's addresses this week, but it was delivered to the press. That was the American Newspaper Publishers Association?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, he was like literally in the belly of the beast.
And he was telling them. Yeah, and the interesting thing about it is that, you know, the whole Bay of Pigs thing was all about the mob, including Meyer Lansky, and I believe he is specifically mentioned as being primarily concerned about this, wanted Cuba back because it was their hellhole for gambling, for, you know, white slavery, for selling drugs. Yeah, it was. That's what they wanted it back for. That's what the Bay of Pigs was all about, was getting their client state back.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, he apparently understood and realized this at some point in an 8 or 9 hour period, and rescinded the orders. And then 10 days later, he gave this speech.
Yeah, this is, over the years, I've seen and heard little bits and pieces about various incidents that have taken place in the lives of politicians where, you know, they have said or done something which was deemed incorrect by the powers that be,
mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about little obscure events now. I'm not talking about some blatantly obvious things that you can expect there to be a response to it. You know, I mean, like John Connally was kind of on a roll towards the Republican presidential nomination, was getting big money and just getting all sorts of media attention, and then he raised questions about the power of the Israeli lobby, and of course that kind of was the
end of his career.
Well, yeah, that's something real obvious. But over the years, I've seen and heard these little stories about strange events, you know, that happen. And this is what I think. This is probably what happened to John F. Kennedy. He saw what it was really all about. I mean, I think he truly believed that he was going to be a real president. I mean, that, you know, this is the kind of makeup, I believe, that the Kennedy family, you know, that was ingrained in them by their father, you know, and then everything, you know, John F. Kennedy's assassinated, and they still thought they were going to get Bobby back in there, and they learned very quickly that they weren't. And, you know, now Ted Kennedy, you know, as I just was talking about this the other day, I actually have a great deal of respect for him. I don't agree with him on a lot of political things. I probably agree with him, in retrospect, probably more with him than I would ever thought I would have, but because I always considered myself to come from a conservative background.
Mm-hmm.
But these days I don't really believe too much in those divisions anymore for a variety of reasons. But there's been a great burden on Ted Kennedy because not only did he, you know, you think back upon the tragedies in his family, and he was the one, the youngest guy, maybe not the smartest guy, but he's the one who had to assume the leadership of the political dynasty and of the family, you know, and he's a very smart guy, actually. I've seen him, I watched him one time walking with some constituents on Capitol Hill. I just had to be very close walking, and I was listening to him, and the guy was discussing legislation and policy issues, you know, with real fervor, with real heart.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot of these guys are just bums who don't know what the hell is going on, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they have their administrative assistants tell them what to do and when to do it. But Ted Kennedy takes himself very seriously, and whatever you think about his politics, you know, you got to give him credit. At least he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
And why he's doing it. And I think that's also one of the reasons why he's been smart in just... the family just doesn't talk about Kennedy assassinations.
Well, I think, you know, from reviewing all the information that I have been going over for quite some time, that I think John and Bobby Kennedy, you know, saw that there were many, many things wrong with the American system, with the fact that the word democracy had been perverted to mean rampant capitalism, you know, dog eat dog. And they decided to use the system itself to get into office to clean it up.
That's exactly, exactly.
And there is, you know, are you familiar with John Hughes, who wrote a book, I believe, with the daughter of one of the mobsters on the subject of the Kennedy assassination? I forget which one it was, but Sam Giancana's daughter.
Yeah, Mafia Princess, I believe, is the name of the book. I may have read that, but I'm not sure. I know of the book, but I'm not sure if I've actually read it.
Yeah. Well, here's what John Hughes says about John and Bobby Kennedy. And I'm reading this just to present the way that they are spinning the Kennedy psyche. He says, Joseph Kennedy taught his kids that they could get away with anything, and no matter what, they could always get away with it. And therefore, we have drug addiction in some of the Kennedy kids. Well, we can get away with it. We'll solve everything. But Bobby Kennedy, oh, many, many instances where he thought he could get away with anything. John Kennedy, believing that he could have intercourse with any woman in the world and get away with it. And so, I think that there was absolutely one feeling amongst the entire Kennedy clan that whatever we want to do, we can do, and we will get away with it. I think this was the Kennedy attitude. And if Bobby were really smart, he would have known, and I'm sure he did know, about the promise that his father made to the mob. If he were really smart, he wouldn't go after the mob the way he did. But it was very selfish on his part. He was going to make his name to get rid of the mob. Of course, it is said that Bobby Kennedy did realize that he, in an interesting way, was the reason his brother got killed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know that's interesting.
Is that sick?
You know, I think that's absolutely correct, because they I mean, you know, just looking at that aspect of who the Kennedys made enemies with. Forget about the Israeli connection. Forget about the oil producers. Just forget everybody. Forget the white racists who didn't like Kennedy's policies on civil rights. Just look at that aspect of the relationship between the Kennedys and organized crime. Now, everybody knows, let's just leave it at that, everybody knows that the Kennedys had relationships with the mob, and just even talking about the Italian-American mafia aspect of it. Okay. Everybody knows it, and yet we also know that Bobby Kennedy, as soon as they got into the White House, they launched this very real war on organized crime.
Absolutely.
And that is like, I mean, you know, for better or for worse, I mean, that is a betrayal of trust.
Well, sure, but
I
it's...
mean, you know, you might not be betraying the nicest people in the world, but, you know, in the world, you know, what do we talk about? Honor among thieves, you know? Well, they just decided, hey, well, we can get away with this.
Well, I'm not sure that I think that it may have been more that they decided we have to use this system in order to take care of this system. We have to bootstrap ourselves in with it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, that's exactly what it came down to. But, you know, there's another interesting element there, too, in regard to this whole issue of the mafia, organized crime. And this is something that Roger Morris and his then-wife, his name escapes me at the moment, I'm getting old here, Roger Morris and his wife, Sally Denton, in their book, The Money and the Power, which is a very excellent history of Las Vegas and the casino industry, and very specifically, they tie in the Israeli connections to it. It's very interesting that they cross that line, and they say what an important part Las Vegas played in the development of the state of Israel. In that book, they also go into the whole history of Estes Kefauver's war against the mob and so forth. And what they point out, and I thought this was very interesting, is that so many of the key democratic political machines around the country were under the domination of organized crime elements. And consequently, when the Kennedys began to move against these organized crime elements, they were, in effect, working to take over those Democratic Party machines in key cities around the United States. So there was, you might be able to look at it and say that there might have been there might have been more than just good government motivations behind the Kennedys' drive against organized crime. You know, there were ulterior, let's put it this way, if there weren't ulterior motives, there were possible gains to be had.
But then if you look overall at his legislation, that, you know, doesn't really support the view that, there was an, you know, a negative ulterior motive.
Oh, no, I understand what, yeah, no, I'm just saying that, but in the end, actually in the end, by gaining control of these Democratic machines, they would have been taking them out of the hands of negative interests and presumably using them in the end.
Well, because
for positive results,
right? Exactly. Because essentially, what Hughes is saying, you know, you should have known if you stood up against evil, evil was going to go after you, so you deserve what you got.
Yeah.
So the thing is, it goes back to what you said. You know, we can kill your sitting president. There's nothing you can do about it. You know, we're showing you and every world leader around the globe that we can do this and we can get away with it.
That's what Vincent Salandria wrote a piece. I may have quoted it somewhere in Final Judgment. It doesn't matter if I did or didn't. But he said that, harkening back to what I was talking about earlier, that his perception is that the whole Warren Commission cover up was actually designed
to fall apart
for that very reason. And if you look at it. In that context, it certainly makes sense.
There's another thing to think about is, for example, the magic bullet theory. The magic bullet theory is almost identical in every respect to the Boeing 767 that hit the Pentagon.
That's a good good parallel. I almost hate to use the term parallel, considering what we're talking about here, physics and so forth. But, it's the same kind of thing, or Building 7.
Yeah.
In New York, I mean, you know, somebody pointed this out the other day that, there you have Larry Silverstein talking about pulling it.
Right.
And it's right in your face. I mean, it's right there, and the term pull it has a very specific meaning in that particular
context,
area.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, it's a term of art that
right.
has to do with whether a building should stay or should it go. And when you say pull a building, that doesn't mean, it means what it means. Pull it.
Well, what we're seeing basically is the execution of terror tactics against entire populations, including the world leaders, by a covert group, what Kennedy called the monolithic the monolithic conspiracy. And, my specialty is more older history, not so much contemporary history. And it reminds me so much of the institution of the Inquisition and what the Catholic Church did to the Cathars. You know, they would go in and destroy an entire city, kill every living person in there, and right away there were an awful lot of conversions to Catholicism and I think that that's even part of the reason why the Abu Ghraib torture scandal was leaked. I think it was deliberate.
That's interesting. In other words, this is what will happen to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now they know that they do torture. Now they know that they legally can torture. Now they know they can lock you up without habeas corpus, without due process of law. And you're encouraged to rat on your friends. And that was, you know, one of the chief elements of the Inquisition that was invented by so-called Saint Dominic. Was to announce that he was coming. Everybody knew what happened, you know, when he came, and that everybody should start to think about, you know, anything they had noticed about any of their friends or neighbors, and to come to make confession and so forth. And
not put the fear of God in you, put the fear of Dominic in you. Yeah.
Yeah. So everybody is sitting there wondering, you know, what does somebody else know about me? You know, what might they say about me? You know, I better say something about them first before they say something about me. And it's essentially an institution of a reign of terror. This is what we are experiencing today.
I was going to say what the word to apply to all that is terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly spiritual terrorism, intellectual terrorism. It may not involve bringing a building down, but it's certainly mind bending. I mean, to have you turning on your neighbors and wondering, you know, what you've said to them, and
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny. I'll give you a good example. Now, did I send you a copy of my book, The Judas Goats?
Yes, you did.
Okay, good. Okay, I was thinking that I had. Well, of course, in the Judas Goats, I tell the story of how I had gotten to know Roy Bullock, who was this undercover informant for the Anti-Defamation League, and you know, I began to, in my own mind, realize what I was dealing with. And you know, it's very interesting because finally, when my boss said to me, "Well, he's ADL," you know, it was like all that time I had been thinking, I wonder what I've said to him that I shouldn't have.
Okay.
And then the next thing Willis Carter said to me was, "What have you told him?"
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, you know, and I'm, you know, and that's the whole, so I can, you know, in a lesser way, I can understand, because, you know, your brain computer, you know, is running at full speed, you know, thinking, uh-oh, what did I tell him about person A? What did I tell him about person B? Oh, wait a minute, he told me something about person C. Was that inside information from the ADL, you know? And it's like a springs are sprung, you know what I mean?
Psychological deviants do have a very special knowledge of normal human psychology, and they use it relentlessly against us.
Yeah, well, see, you know, what's interesting about this guy Bullock, this ADL guy, is that he apparently, if the news reports, I've never asked him about it, I'm going to call him sometime and after I send him a copy of the Judas Goats, his number's still in operation. But, he apparently was inspired by the book I Led Three Lives for the FBI, or I might be mangling the title, but it's the same book that apparently was an inspiration, either a book or a television show, about a person who was a spy within the Communist Party for the FBI. This apparently, they say, was a book or TV show or whatever that Lee Harvey Oswald was very into.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and that's, I think, probably something you find with a lot of these people who get into that world of being informants, wearing disguises, you know, pretending to be one thing. And, you know, you don't know who they're working for sometimes, and a lot of times they may not know who they are working for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's precisely what happened to Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right.
I mean, I've actually, you know, I tell you, I can make a strong case if I sit down and work on it for a couple hours that Lee Harvey Oswald was a forerunner of the modern-day neoconservatives.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He could have been a genuine Trotskyite in the employ of the CIA,
mm-hmm.
who was manipulated by the Mossad,
mm-hmm.
which may have been acting for a faction within Soviet Russia.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, things are not as cut and dried as they appear to be, you know, and...
Well, which also leads us to the obvious conclusion that the Bush gang are working for the so-called, you know, communist revolution.
Exactly. And, you know, see, that's the funny thing about it, you know, people, you know, when I was a kid, when I first started getting politically oriented, you know, of course it was Republican versus Democrat, and then I kind of wisened up a little bit, and I kind of said, oh, well, it's really liberal versus conservative. And then I began to see something that maybe it had to do with more power and money.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start digging in a little deeper, and it gets into areas that are beyond the average person's comprehension.
Exactly.
Yeah, you see, and you know, they and you know, it's funny because they do these studies of the development of political awareness in people, you know, starting at, you know, this age, and then it advances to this and this. I don't think that the average person in the United States, at least, I based upon my traveling abroad and my conversations here in this country with people from abroad, I get a sense that that non-Americans have a better understanding of affairs in their own country and even really in the United States.
They do.
Than most Americans, but the average American, I would say, on a scale of zero being total ignorance and 10 being, you know, perhaps the broadest understanding, most Americans probably don't get beyond level 2.
Yeah, I was going
to... You know what I'm saying? I mean, for you know, I'm putting on that on 0 to 10 scale, but I mean, the average person doesn't even... I don't think the average person even reaches the point of serious partisanship.
No.
You know, there's the hardcore Democrats and the Republicans.
And well, there...
So most Americans are totally out of that realm, and then when you get beyond, to try to conceive of the idea that George Bush is the leader of the communist revolution, mm-hmm. the man who they call the new Ronald Reagan,
right.
You know, to say that to somebody is just like they look at you like, what the hell are you talking about?
And yet it seems to be true. What do you think about the Bush connection to the Kennedy assassination?
Okay, now, I think that the Bushes... There's no question about the fact that George Bush, the old man...
H.W.
George H.W. Bush was moving in those circles down in Texas and in Miami and the anti-Castro Cuban elements. He was in there somewhere.
Yeah.
He was in there somewhere, and I think that fact that he was in there somewhere is part of the reason why he was ultimately elevated to be CIA director and had the inside track in the inner circles mm-hmm. of the higher elite.
Yeah.
Because Ace Hayes, the old publisher of the Portland Free Press, once described, and I thought it was very interesting, it was in a letter to me, described the Kennedy assassination as kind of like the attack on Caesar. Everybody stuck their knife in and bloodied their knife, and
yeah.
everybody, you know, all the leaders there had a hand in it, you know, and they were all implicated. That's what I think kind of what George Bush, he may not have even been in on the planning of it, but he was in there somewhere, just enough to get his hands, get some blood on his shirt sleeves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a little splash of blood on there somewhere, just enough to incriminate him.
Right.
So he was in. He was on the inside track somewhere.
What do you think about you know, something that I came across recently that what's his name, the professor that's involved in the 9/11 movement?
Fetzer.
James Fetzer, that he claims that the Zapruder film is faked. What's the deal on that?
This question of the Zapruder film and his claims about it having been faked, and there's other people who've written on this too. I am not... Okay, I've gone back and forth on it. On the one hand, I say to myself, nah, let's just accept it for what it is. But again, it's one of these situations where there are enough people, in my perception, who seem to have some technical knowledge. I have to accept the word that they have the technical knowledge they have. You know, I used to fool around with 8mm cameras
mm-hmm.
when I was a kid. So I have a little bit, when I read about the Zapruder film, I'm like a couple steps ahead of anybody who's never fooled around or done any editing with any film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've never done that editing and you don't know that there's 8 frames per second or whatever it happens to be, I forget what it is. Now, if you've never done any of that, you have a handicap in reading about things like that. So I'm a little bit ahead of the curve on that. But I have to accept the fact or accept the claims of the people that they know about these technical matters, which in their view indicates that those films were forgeries or that they were combinations of various films. And I think they make the kind of case that would lead you to say, well, maybe this should be investigated further. On the other hand, in the bigger picture, the way I look at it is that there's already so many smoking guns that we don't need new evidence to prove something that we already know, that there was a bigger conspiracy than it was than just Lee Harvey Oswald, and that the government gave a phony story. If you follow what I'm saying, it's like so what else is new?
Well, the one reason that I have some hesitation about this is there's a couple of reasons. One of them is the fact that the Zapruder film was purchased and buried. Who was it? Time Life or whoever that they had it in the vaults, and then somehow it mysteriously disappeared. So obviously somebody wanted to leak it, and then it was returned to the vaults, and then the secondhand copy of it was suddenly put out, apparently through French or Russian intelligence sources. I'm not sure which. The rumor is that it was a combination of both.
It could have been, exactly.
And so that's kind of interesting that there was some inside. And we do see that there are people in these organizations, you know, like the CIA, the FBI, and so on, who do seem to have consciences, who do seem to have benevolent intentions, who are in their jobs because they believe in right.
Yeah, exactly.
And they do come forward now and again and try to get something out without putting themselves too much at risk. So that's an entire possibility. So that's the first reason. The second reason is there was television footage from a distance. From the other side of the motorcade.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And when you see the television footage from the other side of the motorcade, you know, it was being shot from the other direction. You see, you know, the exact same motions. You see Jackie, you know, getting up and crawling out, you know, across, you know, trying to get the pieces of John Kennedy's head to put him back.
On the back of the car, exactly.
Yeah, so you see that there was a matching film that was being broadcast apparently at the time, and so it makes it a little difficult to consider that the Zapruder film was, you know, totally falsified. Though I wouldn't say that it was impossible that a frame or two might have been messed with. Or
yeah, actually, you know what I was going to say though. On the other hand, giving the broadest possible leeway to Fetzer and these other people who've taken the stand. The other side of the coin is that there's this Professor David Rohn. I think he's at the University of Wisconsin. He has written a book about the history of the Zapruder film.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read his book, he thoroughly refutes some of the points that have been raised by Fetzer and his associates. So that's one of those areas that, you know, and it's funny because even Rohn's book, where there are many points in his book that I find very interesting. I mean, one of his points that he emphasizes is that's actually Lee Harvey Oswald in that famous Altkins photograph.
Mm-hmm.
You see the Kennedy limousine in the foreground, and in the background you see the Texas School Book Depository.
Mm-hmm.
In my estimation, he presents a very solid case that was not this gentleman, Billy Nolan Lovelady, but that was, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald standing there on the street. But then, you see, so that I find, you know, in that particular book, you know, I find that particular section of the book thoroughly convincing. Then I read the stuff where he's talking about Professor Fetzer and this aspect of the Zapruder film being manipulated or altered or forged or, you know, a combination of various films, what have you. You read that, and he presents a pretty solid case there that at least in when I'm reading it, it causes me to question whether or not I should believe what they say. But then, here's the funny part about this book, Professor Rohn's book. He takes a whole new position describing the events describing what you see in the Zapruder film,
mm-hmm.
which runs contrary to anything that anybody else has written on the topic.
Mm.
I don't remember exactly the specifics of it, but he takes the position that Kennedy actually, you know, everybody that sees the Zapruder film says, oh, he doesn't move forward, he moves backward because it's obviously a shot from the front.
Right.
Well, Professor Rohn says, well, no, actually, this was a shot from behind, but it was fired at a time that Lee Harvey Oswald couldn't have fired it, or something like this.
Oh,
I mean, like I say, so, So he adds a whole new element to the debate of the forensics of the act itself.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so, you know, it's like this is one of the problems with so much of the literature on the Kennedy assassination.
It's just like the 9/11 thing.
But just like 9/11, whereas, you know, people tend to, it's like going to your apple tree, you know, oh, that's a nice red ripe apple there. Well, I like that one, you know, but let's see. Well, that one's got a worm in it. I'm not going to touch that one, but it's from the same tree. Well, this is what I tried to avoid doing in writing Final mm-hmm. Judgment, and most people who are familiar with the literature who have approached my book, if you know, whether they supported it from the outset or whether they were skeptical, no one has been able to say, oh, you've picked the ripe fruit and ignored the things that don't go along with your topic. I've tried to lay it all out.
Right.
And I have not consciously, that was my big fear when writing the book itself, that I would come across something that would completely contradict my initial thesis, you
mm-hmm.
know, and the thing is, I got into it, I realized within a couple weeks of research and writing combined that I already had about, I was saying to myself, I do have a book here, you know, I was saying to myself, I have the material for a book, but that there was that horrible thought that one day I would open up a new book.
And there would be something you didn't get.
Yeah, and it literally got to the point, you know, that it was becoming a very real fear because, you know, in my mind, in all honesty, I'm saying to myself, God, if I can complete this book and don't find anything, you know, I'll really feel good because in all good conscience, even if I had a 300-page book and I deliberately left out something that I knew contradicted my own findings in my own mind, I couldn't have published the book because
mm-hmm.
I would have known that somebody else would have found it
right.
in a minute and been able to say, not call me a Nazi or call me an anti-Semite or a critic of Israel, but somebody could say, well, Mike Piper left out this fact, which proves beyond any question that the Mossad was entirely innocent, or
right.
you know what I mean? So I couldn't in all good conscience have put the book together. But the funny thing is, even up to the very day I had my manuscript complete, I remember this so clearly. I was sitting on my living room floor. I think I was down there putting the manuscript in a binder. I guess that's why I was sitting on the floor, but I had a binder full of old newsletters that I were putting together, that I was putting together in a binder, and I just happened to open up one of these newsletters. It was published back in like 1971, and there in that newsletter was just another little detail that, as far as I was concerned, was at least the final, not a final nail in the coffin, but an additional nail in the coffin, pounding my thesis down even more tightly, you know. And it was like this was the very day that I was supposed to send the manuscript to the publisher. So I said to myself, "Oh my God! Well, now I got to change the page in the book."
Right.
You know, this is like literally the very day, and I just happened to discover this thing in an old newsletter, and it was a real, real key item, you know, in the bigger picture. I mentioned it in. You can find it in the book itself. It had to do with a strange visit that Jim Garrison got from an oil man
mm-hmm.
who was trying to redirect his investigation, or actually try to get him to drop it altogether in return for a federal judgeship. But like I say, that when this detail came to me, it was just like a culmination of, I kept finding details throughout the research that kept me on the same track. And then when people brought me new information, which sometimes seemed, you know, coming from a different angle or from a different realm, you could all tie it together. So I have always felt morally and intellectually comfortable with everything I've written.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the only errors that have been actually factual errors that have appeared in my book that I'm aware of, most of which I caught myself, you know, were like things like I got dates wrong or things like that.
Yeah, it's easy to do.
No one has ever come out and said, Mike Piper took this quote out of context. Well, no, actually, there was a group of librarians, and that's described in the book, out in Schaumburg, Illinois, Belen's hometown. This group of librarians misquoted something that I said and then refuted their misquotation. You know, but no one has ever been able to show where I took anything out of context, misquoted anyone, anything like that, and that's why in my book I have this section, you know, show me where I'm wrong, you know, in those old Ellery Queen novels, you know.
Right.
They'd always lay out all the clues and, you know, maybe obscure them from you, and then the authors would say, okay, you've seen all the, now it's your chance to solve the mystery. Well, what I've done is said, okay, you tell me where I'm wrong. Show me where I've distorted anything, and all people do is call me names.
Well, I've been called names for quite a few years now myself, so
yeah.
I know what that feels like.
Yeah, you know, H.L. Mencken, who's one of my favorite writers, put together a shimp lexicon. And what that is, if you don't know what it is, it's an unusual term. It's a catalog of, generally, it's a catalog of negative, largely negative commentary about oneself. You know, compiled by one of other things that other people have said about you. And mine is growing by the day.
Yeah, well, I've got a few thousand pages myself.
Yeah, I'm gonna publish a Piper Schimpf lexicon one day. You know, it's sad because I actually, you know, I'm a bit of a book collector. Years ago, I could have had a numbered first edition of that very rare Mencken Schimpf lexicon, and I passed it up. I said, well, I'll pick up another one sometime. You know,
I can't find
one. Yeah, right.
Exactly. In your dreams.
That doesn't happen that way.
Well, there's one little thing about this issue of which direction John Kennedy's head went at what point that is somewhat clarified according to James Files in the Wim Dankbar film. And he says, you know, that he was watching through the scope.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, and at the moment that he had his clear shot, he said that, you know, he was aiming, you know, and it's really, really horrifying to read it, and it upsets me to even talk about it. But he says he was aiming for the eye, and just as he squeezed off the trigger, the head moved suddenly from behind, and he heard the shot, and he realized that the other shooter had shot almost simultaneously. The head went briefly forward, and then when his shot hit, almost, you know, fractions of a second afterward, that's what, you know, made the head go backwards.
That's something, you know, Josiah Thompson, in his book, 6 Seconds in Dallas,
mm-hmm.
had basically put forth that thesis, that there was first a shot from the rear,
mm-hmm.
that came just moments, you know, I shouldn't even say moments before.
Fraction, nanoseconds.
Yeah, before the headshot. And that, to me, with what minimal knowledge of ballistics that I have just from being around guns and from, you know, just from, you know, again, having just a little bit more knowledge, you know, from just being around guns, that made sense to me. And when you consider the fact, as we were talking about earlier, that the likelihood that, you know, bear in mind that the whole time frame of the actual assassination, you know, it takes longer to talk about it in one sentence, one very
right.
brief declarative sentence, than it really actually happened in real time. When you have multiple gunmen firing from several different directions, there were inevitably one shot from one area would obscure a shot from another area.
Right.
You know, you could have had 6 or 7, 8 shots, 10 shots, all in such a time frame and echoing and so forth, that you really couldn't, you know, people in different areas would hear
different things.
Different things, yeah. And, you know, as we all know, eyewitness testimony, a dime a dozen. I mean, you know, so I've always thought that was a very good possibility. You know, I really didn't talk about Files. You mentioned him earlier. I saw a video interview with him a long, long time ago,
mm-hmm.
before Dankbar had gotten involved with it directly. And people have often asked me what I thought about it. I've always said, first of all, that there's no real contradiction of what he says with anything I've written in my book.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, no, it fits right into the framework of what I've written. So I've never considered...
The only objection I have is that it focuses so much on the mob shooters and leaves out other elements that,
Even in that respect, though, Laura, you know, what I would say there is that the reason why it focuses on is because that's all he was privy to.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, he was involved in a particular section of the conspiracy, for whatever want of a better way to put it. Or he was certainly not tuned into everything that was going on in all sorts of different places. So, and you know, as far as his credibility is concerned, you know, I've always thought I've been a pretty good judge of character. Now, watching someone on video is not like being, you know, in the room with someone,
right,
meeting them and so forth, but you know, there have been times where I've watched people, you know, on television or, you know, on videos, and I say, well, I think he's lying.
Right.
I think he has another agenda.
You get a feeling about it.
You get a feeling.
I didn't get that feeling either.
Yeah, see, that's what I mean. I didn't, I thought he came across to me as a guy who had something to say. His ultimate benefits from it are going to be minimal,
if anything.
I mean, because the guy is spending the rest of his life in jail, and he probably can't make any financial benefit from it.
No.
Whatever family he has, if he has any at all, you know, I don't. Like I say, I wasn't ready to dismiss this guy.
And I'm not either.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Now, and if there's someone, generally, if someone comes around with some claim of some sort, whether it's about, you know, JFK or Oklahoma City, there's some people who I, right offhand, I'll either say, well, I think he's lying, or I think he's exaggerating, you know, and there are these people, you know, these people are a dime a dozen, too, who want to place themselves into an historic event,
right,
you know, if only on the periphery. In this case, this guy's saying he pulled the trigger. I haven't met the man, and even if I met the man, you know,
it's a fascinating video.
He's such a good liar that I'd believe him in person.
It's a fascinating video, and I think that it's well worth watching. And
yeah,
there's quite a few other bits of footage in there, you know, from different people, including the forensic pathologist, you know, who goes on to some extent about the magic bullet theory, and he even exhibits the bullet that supposedly fell out of John Connolly on the stretcher, that they say, you know, this is the magic bullet. And then he shows samples of bullets that were test fired, you know, the same type of bullet. And then he shows all the x-rays of the fragments that were taken out of John Connolly's body. And then you compare them to the bullet, which isn't missing any said fragments, you know, and you come to the realization that this, I mean, right there you have essentially, no pun intended, the smoking gun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
you know, I tell you, this whole Kennedy thing, you know, my attitude towards it is, every book, I don't think there's been ever any book since I've written Final Judgment, I should put it this way, there has never been a book that has come out that I haven't read. You know, I'm not prejudiced against it because I think, oh, well, you know, this is, you know, competition or...
No, you're always looking for more information.
Yeah, I have bought... The only one I haven't bought is this, that I can honestly think about, and I just thought of it the other day, is the book by James Tague.
Mm-hmm.
He actually bought a copy of Final Judgment from me, my book, Final Judgment, from me, and I, you know, just got behind because I always have so much to do. He has a new book out in which he just kind of reflects upon his experiences as having been one of the people who was actually one of the, he's the lone survivor of the people who were wounded in Dealey Plaza that day, or at least that we know about. But no, I kind of in the area of JFK research versus and every other area of controversy, I like to read everything that I can get my hands on.
Yeah.
And have the time to read, because there are even books out there's some books that I think are obviously blatant disinformation.
Yeah.
Then there are other books out there by very sincere people who in their own ways, you know, the book might be 300 pages long, and I might dismiss 299 pages of the book
right. As
a rehash of things that I've read 20 times in, you know, 20 times in
mm-hmm.
20 different books, but there might be one page with a little bit of analysis
or important data,
commentary
mm-hmm.
that causes me to stop for a minute and think, you know, and say, well, that ties in with what I believe what I've written, or it might cause me to say, well, wait a minute, is this a problem as far as my book is concerned? And more often than not, you know, I double check on what I've written, and I come away satisfied and say, okay,
I did all right.
There's a problem
here. Yeah.
You know, and then there's a couple books out that are just so such obvious crap.
Hit
like
pieces.
This woman who wrote a book about Jim Garrison that was just so full of crap that it was. I can't think of the woman's name. And then of course Joan Mellon now has come out with kind of a book to counter that book. But on the whole, you know, there's a lot of good people out there who've been sincere people. I'll tell you who's an interesting writer who's got a lot of good insights. He's a British guy named Smith. Douglas Smith.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of just an average name, and it doesn't have a... It's not one of these pretentious names like Michael Collins Piper. It's a name like... I think it's something like John Smith or Daniel Smith or... Yeah, whatever. Anyway, he's written several books on the Kennedy assassination and have gotten some... They've been in the bookstores, the chain bookstores. And I get the impression from this guy, here's a sincere guy who's out there. He doesn't really have, he doesn't have an agenda. He's open to try to, he's in one of these, the quote-unquote sincere truth seeker.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And see, that's a good thing, because there are people out there like that who really are open to it. You know, and it's amazing to me. I found, you know, since my book came out, that I don't know how many letters I've gotten from people. Letters back in the days when people could still write letters. But letters from people saying that how much of an impact the Kennedy assassination had on their lives.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, I used to read about that in books, and it always was kind of distant to me. But then I get letters from people. You know, like this one guy, it's funny, one of my biggest supporters is a guy who's a very well-known professor in the world of Indonesian studies.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he got to be that way was because he was part of the first Peace Corps unit that was sent out in the Kennedy administration, and I think it was to Indonesia.
Right.
Or something like that. I mean, you know, but this guy, he's retired now in Hawaii and everything, you know. And Kennedy's assassination, he met Kennedy right before they went out on their, you know, in their unit. Kennedy's assassination had an impact in his life. And then this other guy who I write about in Final Judgment, Steve Frogue, I mean, he was going out. He was getting ready to join the Peace Corps. And Kennedy was assassinated. He was so inspired by Kennedy. He was going to join the Peace Corps. Kennedy dies, he turns around, he says, I'm going to join the Marines. I don't know if people still react that way.
Well, the funny thing is I think that, you know, it was the masses of people that were hurt by Kennedy's death.
Yeah, see, this is something that I guess, like I say, I had read about, you know, and seen on television, but, you know, it wasn't until a couple years ago that, and that particular night I'd had a few drinks in me, to be completely honest, but I happened to put on a video of coverage of the Kennedy assassination, and I was watching the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this would happen if I'd been completely sober or not, but I'm not one given to tears.
Mm-hmm.
But I broke down. I think it was at that particular time. And then later I said to myself, I'm going to watch that again sober. And I had the same reaction. I think it took that long for me to realize what kind of impact Kennedy's assassination really had.
On the world.
On the world itself, yeah.
And it was... Isn't it amazing that a group of sleazy, slimy, greedy, psychopathic bottom feeders can sit around a table in a restaurant with a few drinks and talk trash and make decisions that literally impact the entire rest of the world?
Yeah, and you see, that's the whole thing. We are literally talking about a small handful of people.
Mm-hmm. How many copies of your book have you sold, or is that a state secret?
No, Final Judgment, actually it's a good question. Final Judgment has sold, or copies have been distributed, in the numbers of somewhere between 45,000 and 50,000.
Excellent.
Yeah,
excellent.
The reason why I can't give you a specific figure is because our own figures on what we have done here in this country are, incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the book is in distribution in Japanese.
Right.
And in Malay and in an English language edition.
Well, those are very good numbers.
Yes. Oh, no, they are. But, when you consider the fact that the average nonfiction book that is published sells a maximum of about 10,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
It's done pretty well. Exactly.
I think this is excellent.
Yeah, it's been over 10 years now, but I knew from the beginning that it was going to be a while, I mean, we sold almost 7,000 copies when we first announced the book. So it got out there, but it took a long time for people to start talking about it.
Right, word of mouth.
Yeah,
if you don't have a major distribution contract with a big-name publisher, it's very difficult.
Exactly, and I never...
So that's extremely good for a book of that type, and hopefully you're going to get some more orders from our listeners. What is the contact information for people who want to order copies of your book?
Well, they can just go right to the American Free Press website at AmericanFreePress.net.
AmericanFreePress.net.
That's it.
And
or the address of American Free Press in Washington. It's in Washington, D.C. It's on Pennsylvania Avenue, which is easy to remember. So give the exact street address on Pennsylvania Avenue. It's 645... Pennsylvania Avenue, Southeast, just S-E, capital S as in Sam, E as in Edward, Southeast, Washington, D.C., 20003.
We would like to thank Michael Collins Piper for talking with Laura. You can order his book, Final Judgment, as well as the many other books he's written, from the website of the American Free Press at AmericanFreePress.net, or you can write to him or them at American Free Press, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue, Southeast, Washington, D.C., 20003. To discuss this podcast or any of the stories that appear on the Signs of the Times pages, you can come to our forum. Just follow the link from the homepage, www.signs-of-the-times.org. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.